then our rules of procedure, protection of the process of finding the truth, would indicate to me anyway, and it seems so logical it's hard for me to say it any other way, that that's exactly the person who should be subjected to the tests of truthfulness that come with a judicial proceeding, not the opposite. And I submit to you that the real danger in this bill is it takes the least reliable witnesses, those who don't qualify as competent under this very minimal standard, and insulates them entirely from any process to determine whether there's any truthfulness or lack of truthfulness to their statement. It is, I would urge you to recognize, a very dangerous thing indeed to present this type of evidence, especially in the highly emotionally charged kinds of cases that are normally going to be involved here. Competence is a minimal requirement, and this statute only exacerbates an existing problem. The other point I would make is that unlike any other state, Oregon has a constitutional provision which specifically precludes the admissibility of hearsay statements except, and I'll quote from the Oregon Supreme Court case that established the principle, except as to those well established, as a quote from State Ex Rel Lonergan v. Gladden, except for those statements which are well established exceptions to the hearsay rule. And basically what the court has said in the past is that a hearsay exception that was in existence at the time of the adoption of the Oregon Constitution is immune from attack under our Confrontation Clause, but that unless it was well established at that time, it violates Article 1, Section 11 of the Oregon Constitution. No other state has that provision in its constitution. Oregon is one of very few states that specifically has interpreted its constitutional provision regarding the right to meet witnesses face to face, and that's the language our constitution uses, different from the federal constitution, to be more rigorous in its protection of the process. And so for those two principal reasons, we urge you to recommend against the passage of this bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Are you saying that a hearsay exception to be valid is somewhat akin to the First Amendment protections that they had to exist at the time of the framing of the Oregon Constitution? Is that what I heard you say?
What I'm saying is that under State Ex Rel Gladden v. Lonergan, or State Ex Rel Lonergan v. Gladden, no, it's Gladden v. Lonergan, 201 Oregon 163, the court held that the rule preserving the right of cross-examination, and I'll read you the whole quote. Quote, under this provision, it is clear that a right to direct examination of one's own witnesses is guaranteed, as well as the right of cross-examination of adverse witnesses, both rights being subject to the well-established exceptions to the hearsay rule, unquote. And under that provision, it is very difficult to create new exceptions simply because, by definition, they aren't well-established.
Blackman, has the U.S. Supreme Court passed on any of these, decided any cases involved with this issue?
Not to my not this particular type of statute, and certainly not one, to my knowledge anyway, that involved the creation of an exception to the hearsay rule based on the incompetence of the witness. Indeed, all of the Supreme Court opinions that deal in this issue focus on indicia of reliability, as has already been mentioned, and I submit to you that if you have the situation of the incompetent witness, you simply cannot overcome the indicia of unreliability because, by definition, that person either lacked the ability to perceive or the ability to report what was perceived.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Candy Bartel.
Senator Hill.
Yes.
My name is Candy Bartel, and these bills that are before you today are very much need to be passed. I am the mother of two sons who have been affected by the lack of have been affected by, severely by sexual abuse. And because the laws, these laws have not been passed as yet, the perpetrator has gone free. There is a severe amount of intimidation, and they're not able to face the additional trauma of coming to court in many instances. I believe that 10 years old and under are additionally traumatized permanently by having to appear in court. My 9-year-old son's therapist has told me that she will not allow her concurrence of him testifying because it could make him psychotic from going beyond what he already has to deal with in a courtroom setting that's very intimidating to a young child. My 14-year-old has also been severely sexually abused, and it happened by their natural father. However, the statute of limitations did not apply for the perpetrator to be charged because my older son did not tell for a number, for over 3 years. He was too afraid to tell. And only when the younger, it became known that the younger son was also being abused, then it came out in the open. I vehemently ask you to pass this bill because the fact that, first of all, children under 10 don't have the cognizance of being attuned to what is required in the courtroom. My younger son says it hurts too much to remember and I don't know how to express it. In counseling and in therapy environment where they can have a trust relationship established, then specifics come out. But just to go into an environment of a stark, impressive big room with microphones and strange people asking questions, it's almost too much for someone older than 10 to deal with. And I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bartel. Any questions? Thank you very much for giving us your experience. Thank you. Before we proceed with other witnesses, there's been a request from one of the committee members to have Tori Streisinger and Mr. Penn and Mr. Collins to come back up and respond to some of the constitutional arguments that have been made. Senator Shoemaker, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wonder if you have looked at the constitutional question, and if you have, whether you have any advice to us on that, about the Gladden versus Lonergan case and the effect that might have on trying to craft another exception to hearsay.
If I may, Senator John Collins from the DA's Association, I think that the fundamental case is the Ohio versus Roberts case, in which the court indicated that if a witness is not available to testify, that statement can still come in without violating the defendant's right of confrontation, provided that there are adequate indicia of reliability.
But that's a different issue, though. This is the Oregon Constitution.
But the Oregon Supreme Court in State versus Campbell has indicated that they will be following the same rule as the federal rule in this on this particular constitutional issue. They've indicated no intent to depart from that. There's another case that, Senator, you may want to consider, and that's Coy versus Ohio. And I don't have the site right here, but it was, I believe, in January of 1988. That dealt with a different issue. It was a case where a child was on the stand and testified.
Let me interrupt that, because I don't think we could probably make that constitutional analysis here. But maybe it, since it has been raised as a problem, I would not like to be passing a law which is later held unconstitutional. Do you suppose you could provide a memorandum to the committee, and perhaps Mr. Blackman could do the same on the other side of the issue, so that we could take a look at that and form some kind of an opinion ourselves, whether we have a problem or not here in that issue?
I'd be glad to do that. I might comment that last session, when this was before this same committee, committee counsel, Mr. Kramer, indicated in his opinion it was constitutional.
Oh, maybe I should ask our counsel, has this been researched sufficiently, Jack, you think?
I think this is a question that, quite frankly, depending on who you ask, you're going to be getting different answers. That Mr. Kramer said that it was constitutional. There is some weight. I don't know whether this is the, is this the identical bill as last time?
Yes.
I think your suggestion that the respective sides brief the issue is a good one, Senator. I would appreciate their help.
May I respond briefly to that, Senator Dale?
I might also mention that there are copies of Poy versus Ohio in your packet, either under the name file or 516, one of the two.
Senator Cohen and Senator Shoemaker, I might say that I agree with Mr. Morris's analysis that this is an issue because there is no direct case on point, that depending on who you talk to, you're going to get a decision or an opinion that this is unconstitutional or this is constitutional. Historically, though, I think it's very important to analyze how we came to this point, because the lead case is going to be State versus Campbell, which is an Oregon Supreme Court case of about 4 years ago. In that case, the Court of Appeals constructed this hearsay exception for children by itself, and they put it in the catch-all exception to the hearsay rule. The Supreme Court said, no, we don't think you can do that because of legislative history, which specifically stated the catch-all hearsay exception will be narrowly drawn, and we will not allow that except in just very small and unique situations. Therefore, if there is to be a child hearsay exception in Oregon, it shall be the legislature that shall provide it to us. That's what that case says. Based upon that, we went forward and drafted the original hearsay bill that has been in the legislature for several sessions. And we have tried to address very specifically U.S. Supreme Court cases, Poy versus Iowa and the other cases, and also the concerns that the Oregon Supreme Court addressed in State versus Campbell. We believe we have done so because not only do we talk about indicia of reliability, we require corroboration of the statement before it is admissible. And a court must make a ruling that this is a corroborated statement and, moreover, it is there is indicia of reliability for this statement before the jury ever hears it. We have tried to put as many safeguards as possible into this bill, and that was our intent, was to ensure that it was constitutional. But no one will know until the Oregon Supreme Court reviews the statute and a specific case of facts.
You didn't mention Gladden versus Lonergan, though, as a case that's part of your analysis. Is that?
Except that, Senator Shoemaker, no, I did not. And I would only state, just from what I heard from Mr. Blackman, I would state that that is dicta in that case. And what we're talking about is not something specifically on point. And that's the problem, because everything that would be cited to you is going to be dicta, because there is no specific child hearsay case in Oregon other than State versus Campbell or in the United States Supreme Court.
Well, if it's a sufficient case to warrant the ACLU arguing from it, and I do respect the ACLU, and their attorneys who appear for them, I think it's worthy of a little bit of study to see whether or not it has a bearing here. Obviously, it's been analyzed from the perspective of a different line of cases, and I think they probably yield on that because they didn't raise those arguments. This raises a new argument, and maybe it is worth a look, and let us have what your advice on it.
Sure.
Corey had a comment first.
Madam Chair, just to echo what Mr. Penn has said, this is an area where we cannot give you any certainty. It is an area where the Supreme Court has issued an invitation in the State versus Campbell case, which we believe this body is entitled to accept. That is not a guarantee that the Supreme Court will then uphold the statute or its application in any particular case. However, I think it is fair to say that the court has not ruled on the issue directly or indirectly, and if this body feels that the public policy behind the proposed bill is strong enough to warrant its adoption, the balance of power says that this body can do that, and then we hear from the court. We will not hear in advance.
So if I may, excuse me, if I may, Chairman Cohen, this bill...
Identify yourself.
Excuse me. Again, for the record, I'm Deborah Wilson from the Attorney General's Office, Department of Justice. This bill was also modeled after the American Bar Association model legislation and their packet. It does have...
Okay, I want to stop you right now because that's part of your testimony, and we actually heard that. We've got some questions from other members here. Senator Grinsky.
I have concerns about the constitutionality of this, but I also wonder, though, on the other side of the coin, one of the biggest problems with these types of cases is that frequently the child is the only witness. What kind of corroborative evidence do you envision which will allow you to introduce this statement without the child actually testifying?
Perhaps, Senator Grinsky, I could respond. Again, John Collins for the District Attorneys Association. On page 4 of my written testimony, I think there were some examples, and included was a confession, an eyewitness account, physical evidence, and access by the accused. The Campbell case is actually a good example because in that instance there was a confession by the defendant, and that certainly would be corroboration of the statement of John.
Well, that doesn't happen all that often.
Well, I think the issue is you're not going to be able to reach beyond those kinds of things with this bill, and I think that's the point that people are trying to say here. It doesn't reach beyond. There are some of those cases that you're not going to pick up with this or anything else because it's not going to be strong enough to bring it in.
It seems.
And we're not, well, we may wish to make it even broader. I think this is probably, your question is driving at those that you're never going to be able to touch, at least unless you go far beyond this bill. And I'd ask you to comment yes or no on that.
I think that's quite accurate.
Senator Hill.
No.
Let me turn to a sort of a different question. As I read this, the child must testify at the proceeding unless the child is unavailable as a witness. He's unavailable as a witness if he's not competent to testify, and Mr. Blackman gave us the definition of competency that apparently is in effect, which would make it rare that a child would not be competent to testify. Thus, if that were the only test, the child would normally have to testify. Let me keep going. The other test is that the child has an incomplete memory, and that was testified against as being too broad, because no one has a complete memory, and thus it would open it up, and virtually any child would be unavailable because his memory is, quote, incomplete, and thus the only testimony would be, the only evidence would be the statement. How do you feel about modifying that clause, the incomplete memory clause, so that it's a tighter standard? And really gets at the concept that the child's memory has to be so incomplete that he or she would not be much of a witness. I don't know quite how we do that.
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, first of all, I'd like to correct my previous testimony in response to your question. I neglected to point that language out to you, that there is a separate definition in this bill. It is somewhat broader than the bill being considered, for example, on the House side, which would include when the child is in fear of testifying. But it is narrower than, in other words, some other language being considered. We would not have an objection to narrowing it still further.
The incomplete memory.
Yes.
Part. Because I don't regard the competence as much of a problem if the test is as Mr. Blackman said it was. It just means the child has to testify himself in most cases. But so okay to tighten up incomplete memory so that it poses a real...
Yeah, may I respond to that, Senator? Senator Cohen?
Please.
Senator Shoemaker, there's a bill, House Bill 2367, that is coming this direction that's very much like this bill. And in that bill, the original version, they used the phrase a substantial lack of memory as opposed to incomplete memory, a substantial lack of memory. And if the committee sees fit to narrow it to
better.
That definition, the DA's Association, while we might favor the broader one, we certainly would not want that issue to hang the bill up in this committee. Then the other thing I would say, regarding Mr. Blackman's testimony on competence, I think he left out an element of competence, and that's the ability to appreciate the nature of an oath. And for kids, it may be that they, oftentimes what I've seen is the child is asked, well, do you promise to tell the truth? They don't use the formalized statement, so it's kind of in a child's language. But in my view, the ability to perceive and relate, as Mr. Blackman indicated, is rarely the problem. What is the problem is kids being able to tell a judge what it means to tell the truth. A lot of adults have trouble with that, let alone kids. So that's where the stumbling block lies on the issue of competence.
Okay. What do you think about that? Should the child be excused from testifying then if he has difficulty knowing what the oath to tell the truth means? Does that make sense? Seems to me it doesn't make sense. The child ought to be a witness, regardless of whether or not he thinks he knows what the oath to tell the truth means.
Well, that's case law, and I believe the rules of evidence now do require that. And so I'm not sure we can change that, though as an aside, I'll say that many states have. Many states leave the issue of competence as an issue of fact for the jury, which is not the rule in Oregon.
Got a number of other folks to testify. So,
Madam Chair, one quick question. Dale, you mentioned in your remarks the diminished value of dicta. Could, for the non-lawyers on the committee, could you just explain real quickly what that is and why it's considered to be of less value in terms of appellate cases?
Senator Cohen and Mr. Morris, dicta. I haven't read this case, so I can't respond to it, and certainly would be prepared to give a memorandum about this, but there will be a precise holding of a case where, for instance, in the Campbell case, where the court stated that the hearsay exception, catch-all exception, will not be allowed to introduce statements by children. May take the court 20 pages to come to that decision. So there'll be lots of other statements, general statements about the law, that are not precisely necessary to give us that single rule of law which the case stands for. And they're simply termed dicta. It may give you some guidance about where the court may be going, but it also may give you incomplete guidance or lead you down the wrong path to rely upon a dicta statement that is not a precise holding of that case. I don't know if that suffices.
It does, thanks.
Thank you very much. Bud Byers?
Thank you, Senator Cohen, and members of the Judiciary Committee. I am Bud Byers, former state representative from District 37. Thank you for the opportunity to share a few words on this proposed legislation. I also wish to thank the committee staff. They've been very helpful. I wish to share some fears I have with Senate Bill 275 and Senate Bill 516. Yes, fears. Since my concerns with both are nearly parallel, I thought to save redundancy, I might cover both together. Hearsay, as provided in Senate Bill 275, and the use of video, as provided in 516, would certainly be prosecutorial tools that all prosecution-oriented individuals would cherish. We must not lose sight of the fact that not all the prosecution-oriented people in the justice system are the police department, CSD, or the district attorney's office. A large number of the judges on the bench are former prosecutors. Some of them, a lot of more of them seeking it, who have never worked the defense side of the system. I'm talking about people who have never defended a case sitting on the bench and ruling. If you have reservations about the statement, just sit through a trial with a former prosecutor on the bench. Not all of them, but in most cases. And compare with the overrule for the defense and, of course, the sustained for the prosecution. My point is that the system will be depending on that or another prosecution-oriented judge to rule on the protections that are alleged to be included in this legislation. Just think about that. These prosecution-oriented people will be sitting there ruling whether or not these alleged protections are what they are. During the 87 session, and I left that session out, similar legislation was considered, and I expressed my belief that it was unconstitutional. Any suggestion that the use of video or hearsay in lieu of child's live court testimony should be rejected. You may or may not be aware of the U.S. Supreme Court case of Coy versus Iowa, which dealt with a related issue of the legality of placing a screen between an alleged victim of child abuse and the citizens accused of that crime. I was pleased, to say the least, that the U.S. Supreme Court interpreted the Sixth Amendment as I have, and ruled that placing a screen between the accuser and the accused in a child abuse case violated the defendant's federal Sixth Amendment right to be confronted with witness against him. With the Corey versus Iowa, the conviction was reversed and remanded and at all great expense to the state of Iowa and to the accused. Justice Scalia, and I hope I pronounced that properly, the Supreme Court Justice might not like mispronouncing his name, traced the origins of the Sixth Amendment right to meet accusers face to face, and referring to Acts 2:25-16, and it says, "It is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man up to die before the accused has met his accuser face to face and has been given a chance to defend himself against the charges." Justice Scalia found support in Roman law for that right and observed that it has been argued that the right of confrontation in England came before the right to jury by trial. Justice Scalia's scholarship included a reference to this in the writings of none other than William Shakespeare, who wrote, "Then call them to our presence face to face, and frowning brow to brow, ourselves will hear the accuser and the accused freely speak." Richard II, Act 1, Scene 1. In light of Coy versus Iowa, the federal constitutionality of the use of videotaping in alleged child abuse cases in Oregon seems highly questionable. Before the scheme has a chance to federal level, though, it has to jump the hurdle for the Oregon Constitution. Article 1, Section 2 of the Oregon Constitution provides in relevant part, "In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall have the right to meet the witness face to face." The terms of the federal constitutional provisions are different. The Sixth Amendment provides in relevant part, "In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be confronted with a witness against him." Thus, it can easily be seen that the terms of the Oregon Constitution make explicit reference to the right to meet witnesses face to face, while the federal provision merely contains the implicit right. In 1954, the Oregon Supreme Court had occasion to discuss the meaning of the difference in textual provisions of the two documents. And I'm not going to go on to all that, but you have it before you, and I think you might want to refer to it. That's one reason it's in a little binder, so you can find them easily. But there is no question but that the main and essential purpose of confrontation as provided in the federal constitution and in similar provisions found in the state constitution is to secure for the accused the opportunity of cross-examination. However, it is recognized that there is a secondary advantage to be gained by the personal appearance of the witnesses before the court and jury, where his testimony is orally given. This advantage is stated by Professor Wigmore as follows: "The judge and jury are enabled to obtain the elusive and incommunicable evidence of a witness' deportment while testifying, and a certain subjective moral effect produced upon the witness. The secondary advantage gained by the personal appearance of a witness before the court and jury is one that applies as well to the state as the accused. Often action speaks louder than words. Persons accused of child sex abuse are presumed innocent until guilt is established beyond a reasonable doubt. That is a fundamental constitutional law. The primary aim of law is to arrive at the truth of the matter in controversy, even and especially when the matter of controversy is as important as child sexual abuse. In child sexual abuse cases, the judge and the jury are entitled to obtain the elusive and incommunicable evidence of a witness, deportment, or witness's deportment while testifying, and the certain subjective moral effect produced upon the witness in child sexual abuse cases. Just as in all other criminal cases, often actions speak louder than words. To deprive a person accused of child sexual abuse the right to obtain the demeanor evidence that in person, in court testimony can only provide is to remove from the truth-finding process an important tool. Shall we turn our back upon the ancient wisdom of mankind concerning the one of the best methods of arriving at truth, so tried and true that they are found in the Holy Bible? Shall we turn our back on the wisdom of the pioneers who established our state's constitutional ground rules for accurate ascertainment of truth? Or shall we do to perceive popular opinion? And I mean, I stress popular opinion, the witch hunt, or whatever you want to call it. Reject these principles that make the accurate ascertainment of truth more possible? Stated another way, shall we sacrifice the conviction of an innocent or a number of innocents because of admitted discomfort occasioned by testifying? I am certain that we are close in our feelings that child abuse in any form is the worst of crimes. The next in line is to be falsely accused of child abuse, let alone being falsely accused and found guilty of abuse of a child or children. The allowing of the use of hearsay evidence provided by a child that has been interrogated, prompted, coerced by an agency personnel or investigators is not in the best interest of the justice system. One of the primary supporters of House Bill 2367, he's also here today, I might tell you, it's D.A. Penn, has stated that simply because a jury has acquitted the defendant does not mean the defendant is innocent. Now, I have him on videotape saying that. Well, you know, it's always been the presumption of innocent until proven guilty, but you see, if you're on the prosecution side of this, you feel the other way about it, obviously. I maintain that the opposite also occurs on occasions. Individuals that are found guilty